This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. No matter your thoughts on America's justice system, one thing is certain. When an innocent person is wrongly convicted, the real criminal walks free. Especially puzzling are cases where someone confesses to a crime they didn't commit. Sometimes truth only comes to light when DNA evidence shows the person who confessed simply could not have been the culprit. Of course, for most crimes, there is no DNA. So it may be troubling to hear that one group of people most likely to falsely confess are teenagers. That's the word from this hour's guests, one legal scholar and two developmental psychologists who've been studying the phenomenon. They say there are steps that would help alleviate the problem, but first, police and the public have to realize there is one. So the challenge and possible solutions in dealing with juvenile crime suspects will be our focus right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. When it comes to criminal investigations, why are teenagers more likely to falsely confess than adults? Are they more likely? And do police need to change their approach to investigating juvenile suspects? And if so, how should they change that approach? Those are among the questions underpinning this hour's discussion. And if you've got thoughts about it, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Already on the phone line with us, a developmental psychologist as well as professor of criminal justice at Virginia Commonwealth University, Haley Cleary. Joining us from a studio in Charlottesville, legal scholar and author of the book Convicting the Innocent, Brandon Garrett. And here with me at the Insight Studios at WMRA, developmental psychologist and author of a new report about the degree of police training in dealing with juveniles, Todd Warner. Thank you all so very much for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Great to talk to you.
Well, Dr. Cleary, let's go to you first. How much should we be concerned about the possibility that a teenage crime suspect will actually confess to a crime he or she did not commit?
Well, we are concerned about that, we meaning researchers. There's evidence to suggest, both from laboratory studies and from some exoneration research, that youth are more likely than adults to falsely confess to crimes. We don't know how frequently this happens. We may never know because it's really difficult to determine. But we know that youth have a greater propensity to falsely confess to crimes, probably because of sort of unique developmental vulnerabilities that they have by virtue of the fact that they are youth and they're still developing socially, emotionally, and even physically.
Yeah, and one of the things I'd just like to add, too, is there's been a lot of developmental research from a psychological perspective, specifically dealing with teens and looking at the parts of the brain that are maturing while you're in your teenage years. And a lot of those areas have to do with impulse control and peer suggestibility, weighing short-term gains versus long-term consequences. So a lot of the areas involved in that really sort of play into this context as well when juveniles are being interrogated for crimes.
Brandon Garrett, can you get in on this too?
Well, juvenile false confessions are certainly in the news these days. The Central Park Five case just settled in New York City for $40 million. It can be extremely expensive and damaging both to the government if they have to pay damages and to the people who need to be compensated after years of spending time in prison for something they didn't do. Those were, you know, juveniles, teenagers interrogated for hours and hours and hours. And the tactics that police use when they interrogate are pretty broad-ranging, but they're designed to make someone think that the smart thing to do is to confess, to admit guilt. And so pressure can be used ranging from deception, fabrication. In the Central Park case, they told kids, you know, your fingerprints were on those shorts. You didn't do it, but you saw your friends hitting her on the head with a tree trunk or a brick. And, you know, that guy is saying that you raped her, but we, you know, tell us who really did. All kinds of tactics, wearing someone down over many, many, many hours. Adults falsely confess under those circumstances. But you can imagine how teenagers would more readily. A lot of those Central Park kids actually had parents or guardians there at the station who told them, you know, cooperate. And it's interesting that having a parent or guardian present, which some see as a potential protection for kids, actually can work the other way and encourage them to comply with authority even more.
Well, Dr. Cleary, your youth behavior and decision-making while interacting with police has been a special area of research for you. Give us, if you would, some of the highlights of what you've been discovering.
Well, we conducted a small study where we looked at videotaped interrogations of youth from police departments all over the world. And we found that behavior and even the interrogation process itself is very variable. And this is not a message that often comes through in sort of pop culture, because TV and film portrays juvenile interrogations in one way. But it's not always the most accurate way. Sometimes interrogations are very short. Sometimes they're extraordinarily long. I think average in our study was about 45 minutes, but the duration of the interrogation ranged from 6 minutes to nearly 5 hours in just this one small sample. So, you know, this, you know, when Brandon raised the point about the Central Park Five, it raises this question about interrogation duration and whether that's related to the propensity of youth to falsely confess. We think it might. We need a lot more research on this area, but certain factors that are associated with adolescence, things like suggestibility, to influence, with compliance with authority figures, all lead us to suspect that we might need some special protections for kids in the interrogation room, even more so than adults.
Civil rights attorney Brandon Garrett is a professor of law at the University of Virginia. Developmental psychologist Haley Cleary is a faculty member in the Department of Criminal Justice at Virginia Commonwealth University. And developmental psychology researcher Todd Warner is a doctoral candidate at UVA. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you'd like to talk to our guests, 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our phone number. In all numbers, it's 888-967-2825. Or you can reach us on Facebook, the no talking, just typing way of communicating. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we have this here from Lawrence, who says, I thought police were required to notify a parent before bringing an underage teen in for questioning, but I now understand that that is not always the case. Could you please describe what the exceptions to this rule are? Brandon Garrett, it sounds to me like Lawrence's question touches on something I heard you say a few moments ago.
Yes.
So could you go first, please?
Well, it's a perfect time to ask me this question. the reason why is that I've just been reading responses from almost 200 Virginia law enforcement agencies when students at University of Virginia Law School at the Virginia Innocence Project student group FOIA'd every police agency in the state, asking them for their interrogation policies and lineup policies and other things. And so I've just been sitting with this enormous stack of Virginia law enforcement policies on interrogation, and I have now read all of them. There is no rule that parents or guardians have to be notified. And in fact, although most of the policies that I read said something about parents or guardians being notified, they typically said, you know, if feasible, contact the parent or guardian. And often they said, okay, well, once you do contact the parent or guardian, basically make sure they're around when the kid waives Miranda rights. A couple of them said, oh, no, the parent or guardian should be present during the duration. A few said, no, you are absolutely required to notify them, not just if it's reasonable or if it's feasible. And that was typically the sum and substance of what the policy said about juveniles, period. The policies typically didn't say much at all about how to approach juvenile interrogations. And in fact, there's guidance in Virginia. There's a great model policy from the Department of Criminal Justice Services with a whole set of recommendations for how to interrogate juveniles more fairly and more carefully. One thing they say, and this is what made Haley's really fascinating sounding study possible, they say you should always videotape or electronically record interrogations of juveniles, so there's a record of what everyone said. There is only one agency in Virginia that I know of that requires the recording of juvenile interrogations. Just one.
Yes. And which one is that?
Right here in Charlottesville.
Yeah, and one thing I'd like to add is a lot of people, this is sort of a common question that we get also, you know, when we're conducting research on interrogation as well. Just bring in the parents, and the parents will invoke Miranda rights, and, you know, they'll sort of protect the kid from incriminating him or herself. There's been a little bit of research on this, and it's showing a couple different things. One is that a lot of times parents, in fact, don't really even fully understand Miranda, the functionality, or really how critically important it can be. But also, a lot of times the parents will encourage the kids to cooperate with police, which may not, you know, be in fact in their best interest. And they sort of just want this to all go away. And, you know, I just want this to be put behind us and sort of move on. When in fact it could, you know, have really potentially negative long-term consequences for the kid.
Dr. Cleary?
Yes, that's a great point. And I think it's important to remember, too, where parents are coming from in this situation. So when we think about the role of parents sort of in larger society, it's easy to imagine how conflicted they might be in a situation like this. On the one hand, you want to protect your child, right? If people are accusing your child of doing something wrong, if there's potential for legal consequences, as a parent, it's reasonable to want to shield your child from any kind of harm, including legal harm. On the other hand, it's the role of parents in society to socialize our children, you know, to bring them up to be upstanding members of society. I am newly a parent myself, so I'm feeling all of these things, you know, in a really new and real way. You want to teach your children to own up to their actions and to take responsibility for their consequences. So if you think about parents in the interrogation room, those two opposing forces are kind of diametrically opposed in that situation. And I had a very few number of parents in my study, but I saw a whole range of those behaviors on both ends of the spectrum, parents trying to protect their children from the police's accusations, and also parents almost kind of teaming up with the police officer, you know, saying things to the child like, you need to tell him everything he wants to know. You need to confess to what you did.
And also in terms of, and Brandon might actually be a little bit more familiar with this, but across the country, I think there is some state policies where there's laws saying that they have to notify the parents before they're questioned. But I think it varies from state to state. And obviously from department to department, but there's not as many laws stipulating that as I think most people would probably assume is the case.
There are actually, I think, kind of a lot of misconceptions that people have about what police can do or should do when it comes to interrogating youth. One aspect we encounter a lot in our when we're talking about our research with others is the fact that police can lie in interviews. I think a lot of even adults in the legal community don't necessarily know that, but police can absolutely lie in the interrogation room. And if the suspect, especially a juvenile suspect, isn't aware of something like that, then it can really kind of change the dynamic of the interrogation and perhaps influence the judgment and the decision-making that youth have inside the interrogation room.
Developmental psychology researchers Todd Warner and Haley Cleary, along with legal scholar Brandon Garrett, are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Brandon Garrett, are you offended that police are allowed to lie in interrogations?
Well, we've certainly seen how police use of trickery and deception has caused some really high-profile wrongful convictions. And courts, nevertheless, say that police have free rein, really, to use all sorts of trickery and fabrication, false evidence. Your DNA was at the scene. Your friends told us that you were the one who had the gun, whatever it is. Courts say you can use all of that stuff so long as you don't totally overbear the suspect's will. Who knows what that means?
Well, maybe we'll discuss that, all that stuff. Specific issue a little bit more just a little later in the show. But since we've got two psychologists with us who study juveniles, I want to ask the two of you about kids' brains and brain development and how you think that affects what we're discussing here, and remind anybody listening that you're perfectly encouraged to come up with your own questions. We'll be back in just a bit more than 1 minute. WMRA's Virginia Insight. Although her doctorate is in psychology, Haley Cleary is an assistant professor of criminal justice at Virginia Commonwealth University. She's speaking with us by phone. Her collaborator in recent research, Todd Warner, is close to receiving his doctorate at the University of Virginia. He's here in the Insight studio. Also with us, Brandon Garrett, a named professor at the UVA Law School and author of the book Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Go Wrong. Brandon is speaking to us from a studio in Charlottesville. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. So who wants to explain kids' brains to me? Excuse me, teenagers' brains.
Well, that's kind of a tall order. But we have.
Go ahead and take a stab at that, Haley.
Yes. We've learned a lot about the teenage brain in, I would say, the last 15, 20 years, largely because of the advent of fMRI research. So functional magnetic resonance imaging allows neuroscientists to not just take pictures of the brain like an MRI would, but actually look at the way the brain kind of moves and changes. And what we've learned from kind of a new wave of developmental neuroscience research is that the adolescent brain is changing and developing much, much longer and later than we originally thought. So the general consensus in the scientific community right now is that human brain development doesn't really sort of stabilize until as late as the mid-20s. So, you know, that's a much longer period of kind of adolescence than we're used to thinking about. And when we think about how those kinds of neurological changes might impact youth, it tends to happen with regard to the prefrontal cortex. So we know that the parts of the brain that are the last to develop in people are the parts of the brain that develop and control executive functioning. So these are things like decision-making, impulse control, the ability to delay gratification. You know, these are things that we all have to develop over time, but they tend to develop later than other human skills. And so if our judgment isn't what it's going to be more or less for the rest of our lives until the mid-20s, then that has kind of a lot of important implications for decision-making when you're being questioned by a police officer.
Yes, absolutely. The science that's been coming out, this is Todd from UVA, has pretty, so the scientific community has come to a consensus that adolescent brains are still developing, but more importantly, the parts of the brain that are developing are the parts of the brain that are responsible for impulse control, for weighing long-term consequences versus short-term gains. And Haley actually, in her paper that just recently came out, looked at a lot of the contextual factors of interrogation, too, that have to do with the actual setting, so the environment. And the environment is designed to isolate suspects, to make it an undesirable place to be. There's nothing in there. There's nothing to look at. It's a place that you want to get out of. And when you have adolescents, you know, with, you know, underdeveloped brain, so to speak, this, you know, impulse control, I just want to get out of here, you know, not being able to appropriately weigh the long-term consequences of what might happen. You can see that, you know, adolescent vulnerabilities really sort of start putting them at risk in this particular context.
Well, lay out the specifics for me. Is one of the things that you're saying, Todd Warner, is if I'm 16 and my executive functions, especially those dealing with delaying gratification, are still underdeveloped, and police are questioning me, maybe implying if I just admit that I've done what they accuse me of doing, that I'll be able to get out of this awful place, that then I'm not thinking about what making that admission might lead to on the long term?
Yes, that's pretty much what we've been saying, and it's, you know, a lot of adolescents don't really fully understand that if you, you know, make a self-incriminating admission to a particular crime, that it's going to have long-term consequences. And A lot of people argue that teenagers are under the belief that if they just confess, that they'll be able to go home. And, you know, in many instances, they're being interrogated for very serious crimes. And, of course, if they confess to those crimes, the reality is that a lot of times they're not going to be able to go home. Or maybe they do, but they still will have to come back to court. It'll still have to, you know, get adjudicated and whatnot, and could lead to, you know, long-term consequences.
Legal scholar Brandon Garrett.
So courts have cited to this adolescent brain research a tiny bit. The U.S. Supreme Court says you can't execute juveniles since their brains aren't fully formed. One reason is that they've cited that evidence that juveniles don't have the reasoning capacity to do things that deserve the death penalty, even if they might kill. Courts called into question life sentences for juveniles. And the Supreme Court has said a juvenile might feel custody differently. Maybe an adult who's being informally questioned might understand that they're free to leave. But the court said, you know, being a juvenile is a factor, at least, when you consider whether someone should really feel like they're free to leave or not. But that's basically it. That's the limit of what the courts do when they think about the status of being a juvenile. It might be a factor when you think about whether too much pressure is placed on someone, but what it means, who knows? And maybe that explains why police basically, from what evidence we have, seem to mostly interrogate juveniles the same way that they do adults. And in fact, the leading training manuals say, well, you can do your own assessment to see whether this juvenile seems really mature or not, but basically use the same techniques you might otherwise use. And that just doesn't make any sense, but police don't receive typically special training on how to approach juvenile suspects. Some kids, you know, you might be able to get them to confess true or false to something in 20 minutes, half an hour. But then imagine what you could do with hours and hours of prolonged course of interrogation.
Yeah, and that's actually a line of research that Haley and I and my advisor, Dick Rapucci, have been embarking on, is to try and figure out what kinds of training that police do receive, because the purported most common method is what's called the Reed technique. But there really isn't a lot of research on how many officers actually receive this training, what types of training they get for adolescent development, for how they question and interrogate adults and juveniles. And so this is actually something that we're currently investigating.
Brandon Garrett, when you were here 1 year ago, just around the time of the publication of your latest book, Convicting the Innocent, you discussed the Reed technique at length, and if I recall correctly, it wasn't pretty.
Well, it's an awfully ill-defined, flexible technique, but the basic idea is you start off by playing nice and making the person feel very comfortable, and we're just here to talk. While things are nice and informal like that, of course, you have the person waive their Miranda rights. You know, we don't need a lawyer here, right? We're just here to talk. I just want to get to know you, ask you some questions, and then we'll call it quits. And then, of course, once everything is calm and the person has waived all their constitutional rights, then there's a total flip. And the officer says, basically, I know you did it. This is what you did. It's disgusting. It's horrible. You better confess your guilt. You have no choice. We have everything on you. And if the person wavers or gives excuses, then all kinds of strange storytelling can happen where they say, well, you know, your friends all say that, you know, you were the rapist, but maybe one of them was. Maybe you were just there watching. Tell us what really happened. It's kind of like in the Central Park case. And so all sorts of stories are told and different versions are exchanged. Maybe fabrications are done. Maybe a polygraph is done for the purpose of telling the person, oh, you failed a lie detector. We know you're not telling the truth. Your parents are outside. Should we go out and tell them how you've been lying to us for hours? All kinds of things like that can be told to a person, whether they're a juvenile or not. And so the technique is really a whole series of manipulations, psychological. It was thought to be, you know, progressive. You know, we're not going to torture people anymore. Now we're just going to rely on psychological coercion. But it is really a no-holds-barred barrage of different manipulations. Other countries don't do interrogation like that. There's an approach in the U.K. that some trainers in the U.S. are just starting to introduce, which just doesn't do that. But for the most part, as far as we know, the Reed technique is sort of the authoritative technique, and the Reed Institute does training all around the country.
Civil rights attorney Brandon Garrett is a professor of law at the University of Virginia. Developmental psychologist Haley Cleary is a faculty member in the Department of Criminal Justice at Virginia Commonwealth University, and developmental psychology researcher Todd Warner is a doctoral candidate at UVA. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Brandon Garrett, tell us about how the juvenile justice system and juvenile courts are different than adult courts and how that relates to what we're talking about.
You know, maybe some listeners have heard of the case of Edgar Coker. That's a case that folks at UVA Law School worked on, not me, our Innocence Project Clinic, as well as our Juvenile Justice Clinic. Deirdre Enright, Matt Engel, Andy Block. It took a whole group of lawyers, years and years and years, to finally get his conviction reversed. And he was a juvenile. And almost immediately after, his friend said, no, he didn't rape me. You know, they were basically boyfriend and girlfriend. But they were sort of caught in the act, and she immediately said she was assaulted. But then the second that was over, she said, no, nothing wrong happened.
He was 15 at the time, wasn't he?
Yes, he was just 15 years old.
Okay.
And when new evidence was finally presented to the juvenile court judge did say, okay, I'm letting him out. But then how do you vacate the conviction? The reason why he initially pleaded guilty was there's something really unusual in Virginia. Almost no other states have this. Prosecutors have almost complete discretion in Virginia to take a case from juvenile court to adult court. And what this prosecutor basically told Edgar Coker and his family was, you plead guilty now, otherwise this case is going to adult court. You're going to face years in adult prison. You're going to be transferred to an adult detention facility now. Who knows what will happen to you there? Or take this deal this instant. And they said, no, but talk to the victim. You know, she'll tell you, her family will tell you nothing happened. Too bad. This is the deal. Take it or leave it. And with that on the table, he took it. Now, no other state has a juvenile justice system like that, where you can just get thrown into adult court just like that. And in the juvenile system in Virginia, like in many states, confessions are seen as really required or demanded or prized. You know, you're going to get leniency if you come clean and take responsibility. You're expected to confess. Although what was really amazing about his case was that years and years later, when his lawyers finally got access to the tape, which the prosecutor had said that it contained his confession, there was no confession. He never confessed. He said he was innocent all along.
Well, wait a minute. Let me double check and make sure I understand what you just said. The prosecution claimed that this 15-year-old confessed.
And his lawyer said,
was videotaped, but his defense lawyers never looked at the tape?
Apparently the lawyer never listened to the tape or never watched the tape. I don't know whether it was audio or video. But he actually had not confessed. And so that's problematic from the perspective of what was the defense lawyer doing? But what was the prosecutor doing? What was the judge doing? Why is it that it took so many years to uncover that information? And why did that case get charged that way? You're going to adult court. When from day one, the victim said, you know what? I never should have reported this. Nothing happened. And that's just one case that we happen to know about. In how many other cases would the victim be so forthcoming and realize that something wrong had happened? And how many cases would there be a tape, given how rarely police agencies in Virginia are actually required, at least, to tape interrogations?
Yeah, if I can just jump in for a second here. I wanted
this
to go back to a point Brandon was talking about earlier with the Reed technique and how police interrogate suspects. And it's sort of the way I see it is generally a two-step process where, as Brandon was saying, they bring people in and it usually starts off somewhat less formal, a little more casual. They're usually trying to build some rapport there. And they get trained, according to the Reed technique, to analyze various verbal indicators and nonverbal indicators of truth-telling and deception, you know, at least according to the training. But one thing that we know, and this has been pretty clear from the psychological research, is that police are not good at being able to discern accurately who is actually lying and who is telling the truth. I mean, there's been multiple studies where it's shown that they're basically no better than chance. And we bring, you know, college students in or other people off the street, and we can train them, and it's basically a 50-50 chance. Again, where we see the biggest difference, though, is with police officers or other people that, you know, work in law enforcement, is that they're very confident in their ability to do this. And so during the course of an interrogation, there's this I don't really have a term for it, but there's this threshold that they, you know, the suspect seems to pass at a certain point. And once they pass that point and the detective thinks that this is the suspect, they have all these different psychological techniques that they're trained to employ and trained to use to get you to make a self-incriminating statement. And I think one of the biggest myths that a lot of people have is that, you know, police are trying to determine the truth and determine what really happened, when, in fact, we can never actually figure that out. You know, their goal, once it gets past that threshold, is to get a self-incriminating statement or to get a confession. That is the goal. And a lot of times they, you know, it's what we call hindsight bias, or they'll take, you know, some kind of conflicting evidence, or, you know, perhaps another suspect comes to the fold that they should pursue. But a lot of times they won't do that because they'll really hone in on that one person.
I think it's important to add as well, just to follow up on Todd's comments, that, you know, there's a lot of legwork that goes into investigations before, hopefully there's a lot of legwork that comes along before an interrogation happens. So police are trained not to bring someone into the interrogation room unless they have reason to believe that that person was involved. So it's not the case that, you know, police are just kind of grabbing people off the street left and right and hauling them down to the police station and, you know, asking them a bunch of questions for 6 hours. I don't think that happens with a lot of regularity. I think something that gets lost in these conversations sometimes is that, you know, we're kind of all on the same team, right? So police officers want to get a confession, but only if it's true. So, you know, law enforcement officers have no reason to really want a false confession any more than anyone else would, because they're trying to kind of catch the bad guys, and that's a really difficult job. And it's something I think we take for granted a lot, because we see maybe the way law enforcement careers are portrayed in films or TV or what have you. It's a really difficult job. It's a really dangerous job. It's often an underpaid job. And, you know, if you think about all of the pressures that law enforcement face, maybe it's pressure from the victims' families to close the case and solve the crime, or victims from the, pressure from the city to raise clearance rates. It's a hard job. And so we want to help police have the tools that they need to get the most accurate information possible.
Developmental psychology researchers Haley Cleary and Todd Warner, along with legal scholar Brandon Garrett, are our guests, looking at juvenile interrogations and how police deal with juvenile suspects. And we continue in 1 minute. Civil rights attorney Brandon Garrett is a professor of law at the University of Virginia. Developmental psychologist Haley Cleary is a faculty member in the Department of Criminal Justice at Virginia Commonwealth University, and developmental psychology researcher Todd Warner is a doctoral candidate at UVA. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Well, it's my understanding, Dr. Cleary, that some researchers say juveniles tend to be more compliant with authority than adults. And I'm thinking that may come as a surprise to any parent of a teenage daughter or son. So could you please explain what more compliant with authority actually means?
Sure. So I know that's kind of a counterintuitive to parents of adolescents, but, you know, in general, when we look at youth social development over the teenage years, when you compare a group of adolescents to a group of adults, it seems to be the case that youth are more likely to comply with requests from authority figures than adults would be. And this is actually something that starts very, very young. So obviously children, right, are more compliant with adults, and that sort of tendency toward compliance kind of agreeing with statements that are posed to you or doing things that are asked of you. It's just kind of a general tendency that is more characteristic of youth than it is of adults, which is probably good news for the parents out there, right? We're doing something right. But it poses problems in the interrogation context. We see this in particular with research on suggestibility. So that's a term that psychologists use to refer to the idea that someone is particularly vulnerable to feedback from others. So with interrogation, sometimes we see situations where police are either intentionally or unintentionally providing details about a crime to the juvenile suspect, and we see those details become incorporated into the youth narrative. So obviously this is a big concern in the false confession cases. But even that's kind of an extreme example. On the sort of less extreme end of the spectrum, even things like giving kind of cues that that wasn't the answer you were looking for, or, you know, that wasn't kind of the information you were hoping for, youth exhibit a tendency to kind of change their stories or to kind of reroute the conversation in response to that negative feedback, as opposed to, for example, insisting that the narrative that they provided is the most accurate one.
This is, of course, also an important issue for law enforcement when they're talking to child victims. And there's the concern that child victims can be suggestible. You want to find out their own version of what happened and not suggest anything to them. And that's why it's really important when you're interviewing a juvenile for any reason, if it's a witness to a crime or a victim of a crime or a juvenile that you suspect of having committed a crime, really important to have special training on how to talk to juveniles.
That's a great point. And we've actually learned a lot more recently about proper ways to interview youth that have been borrowed largely from the child victim and witness interviewing, sort of forensic interviewing literature. And Brandon referred to this earlier in the program, but the U.S. is different from other countries, especially European countries, in a lot of ways with how they interview suspects. So investigative interviewing is a style of interviewing that's sort of more fact-finding oriented. It's less accusatory. It's predicated on kind of developing a good rapport with the person and showing them respect and dignity during the interview, which is, you know, a different style sometimes than the one that's taught here in the U.S. And there's some early research beginning to indicate that that might be a better approach with kids or with adults if you're looking to get accurate information, that that kind of interviewing style is associated with more accurate reports than a more sort of accusatorial approach.
Dr. Haley Cleary, I apologize if I'm putting you on the spot here, but I just wanted to check. Can you think off the top of your head of an example of how this might work, one style versus the other? A specific maybe type of question or way of approaching a suspect?
Sure. So investigative interviewing, sort of generally speaking, tends to be to involve more open-ended questions. So tell me what happened. What happened next? Where did you go after you left the party, for example? That sort of thing. As opposed to something like, I know you were there that night. You know, your friends have already told me everything. It's best if you just give me all the details now. This will go a lot easier for you, you know, in the long run. So it's just kind of a different way of going about getting information. It allows the suspect to give his or her account, hopefully in the absence of pressure, kind of minimize the amount of stress or pressure that they may feel in the situation, which might trigger inaccurate information or any kind of resistance. So that's kind of a general example of accusatorial versus kind of fact-finding types of questions.
Well, and just a quick point about the compliance to authority figures with juveniles. One place where it in particular is troublesome is with the Miranda warning, right? And so you're talking to an authority figure. They're giving you the Miranda warning. You have the right to remain silent, you know, have an attorney present, and so forth. And, you know, but police officers are trained in various ways to sort of make it seem like a formality, or, I mean, it's a really interesting dynamic because on the one hand, police are legally, you know, legally they have to tell the suspect that they have the right to remain silent, they have the right to an attorney, but yet, you know, it's obviously not in their best interest, usually, if the suspect invokes those, because they want to elicit information from the suspect. And so with juveniles and being more likely to comply with authority, we have some research that shows that juveniles pretty much just waive Miranda rights. I mean, there's studies that show over 90% of juveniles, you know, don't invoke their Miranda rights when they're being questioned by police. And this just goes with what we know with them being more suggestible to authority figures.
Brandon Garrett?
My vague recollection was that there was a study done in Virginia on juvenile understanding of Miranda, which suggested that juveniles, when they heard those warnings, what they understood was, I'm supposed to cooperate. Basically, they heard words coming from an authority figure that sounded legal and important, and their understanding of them was that after you're given those warnings, that's when you're supposed to do whatever they say.
Well, there has been some laboratory-based research that looks at kids sort of essentially reading comprehension and their cognitive functioning, whether or not they actually understand the words and phrases that are used in typical Miranda warnings. And I use the word typical loosely there because there's been kind of a new body of research showing that Miranda warnings are far from standard. They vary, you know, from department to department pretty considerably. But this research suggests that kids, in general, less comprehend the not just the function of these rights, which is really important, right? We want suspects of any age to understand that these are constitutional rights, that you have the right to an attorney present, you have the right to not to speak, to remain silent. That's your legal entitlement. So not only do kids less understand the function of the rights, sometimes they don't even understand the actual words. Anything you say can will be used against you. Well, there's a type of test that you can use where you ask kids to say, well, what does it mean to use something against you? And they can't explain it sometimes in their own words because they don't really understand what that means. And so we see kind of changes across the adolescent age period as well, with younger adolescents showing more comprehension problems than older adolescents. But if kids don't even understand the words that are being spoken to them, kind of couple that with, you know, an authority figure, maybe dressed in a uniform, telling you what to do, it's kind of a recipe for disaster.
Her doctorate is in psychology, but Haley Cleary is an assistant professor of criminal justice at Virginia Commonwealth University. Her collaborator in recent research, Todd Warner, is close to receiving his doctorate at the University of Virginia. Brandon Garrett is a named professor at the University of Virginia Law School and author of the book Convicting the Innocent. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. Brandon, you've said in the past that North Carolina had been doing a much better job than Virginia at trying to find and exonerate wrongful convictions. I'm curious if you see that state or any others doing especially good work at changing their approach to juvenile suspects.
Well, there are over 15 states now that videotape all interrogations generally. It was a big move. The FBI just announced that all federal interrogations will be electronically recorded with some narrow exceptions. But I was really disappointed to learn that in Virginia, where we do have pretty good model policies from DCJS, the Department of Criminal Justice Services, describing how juveniles should be interrogated quite differently, I was really disappointed to see how few agencies actually follow that policy, at least in their written policies. Maybe some departments do things on their own, which they don't put in writing. But there aren't real good reasons to be optimistic about how agencies across Virginia are handling juvenile interrogations. And it seems like it's an area that's really ripe for public attention and a lot of hard work.
Yeah, and I think things are very slowly turning. I think just last week, and Haley, jump in on this too if I get this a little bit wrong, but it was the International Association of Chiefs of Police in collaboration with the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention came out with a new sort of training, a guideline for their recommendations for juvenile interrogation. This just came out, I think, last week, and we obviously haven't gotten access to look and see what those specific recommendations are, but they are starting to sort of turn the corner. And like Brandon said, I think they're starting to understand that, you know, some of these, you know, false confession cases, they get tons of publicity, get tons of negative attention for police detectives, and they're very costly. You know, the Central Park Five settlement and these cases go on and on and on for a long time. And so they are sort of slowly turning the corner. And, you know, and some of the Supreme Court cases, specifically Roper and Graham and Sullivan, I think have actually sort of started to shift the tide to where they're starting to actually embrace some of these recommendations that are more developmentally appropriate. But I think it's happening, you know, pretty slowly.
Dr. Cleary?
I would agree, but it's good news that it's happening, and we're seeing it happening at the federal level and at the state level as well. So in the sort of in the mid to late 90s, there was kind of a huge swing in juvenile justice policy toward a greater emphasis on punishment and consequences. We saw the rates of transfer of juvenile defendants to adult court skyrocket, and there was kind of a rush of new policies expanding the mechanisms by which juvenile defendants could be transferred to adult courts. We're starting to see states backpedal on that a little bit now because there were ill effects of that, that there's research suggesting that transferring kids does not result in good outcomes, and it's better to keep kids for a lot of reasons in the juvenile system. We're seeing this with regard to interrogation as well. You know, again, I think it's important to remember that, you know, police departments want to get it right. It's not the case that interviewing officers want to put the wrong person away for a crime. So I think, you know, researchers like ourselves can really help out by giving practitioners the tools that they need that are research-based, that are empirically based.
Well, Haley, hold on for just a second, and sure. I apologize because we're almost out of time, and there was one all-important question that I still needed to ask. But I understand that we've just gotten a call from a gentleman in Harrisonburg named Rusty, who apparently has the same question. Rusty, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Thank you for doing this segment. I would like to know what some of the ideal changes that you could make to yield the most results the fastest, or what some of your kind of like hoop dream ideas about this are, you know, that could make the biggest, fastest changes that...
So basically, and Haley, I think you may have been getting close to this point, Rusty is asking, how do we fix it?
Well, I think the number one thing that we can do is require the presence of an attorney whenever a police questions youth. I don't believe that parents are sufficient to play that role. They're not trained to provide legal counsel. Youth should always be interviewed in the presence of legal counsel.
Brandon Garrett?
Those interviews should also always be videotaped in their entirety. Kids should only be interviewed by one officer, not by whole groups of officers. And the length of these interrogations of kids should be short, never more than 2 hours. Really, normally shouldn't be more than an hour. There should also be limits on deception and other fabrications, other coercive techniques. There's no need for those kinds of psychologically manipulative techniques when you're interviewing kids.
Brandon Garrett, do you agree with Haley Cleary's assertion that a lawyer should automatically be involved as a defense counsel whenever a juvenile is being interrogated?
Well, I can see very strong resistance to that idea from law enforcement, but that would certainly be a very strong protection.
Yeah, it would actually be a very strong protection.
Is there some concern here about hamstringing police, that they, as Haley has pointed out several times, have a very hard job? They're trying to find the right criminal suspect and see that that person is put to justice.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I just want to reiterate what Haley was saying a little bit ago about how difficult this is for detectives and investigators. I mean, in many of these cases, they have, you know, very little evidence to go on other than, you know, eyewitness accounts or you know, relationships that they've built in the community. So they kind of know, based on the crime, you know, who's kind of enemies with who.
But you all agree with Brandon that all of these interrogations should be videotaped? That would be an important first step?
It's in their best interest.
Yeah. Rusty, such a great question. Thanks for calling in. Our guests have been Todd Warner, doctoral candidate in the psychology department at the University of Virginia, and author of a new report about levels of police training in juvenile interrogations. Brandon Garrett, professor of law at UVA and author of the book Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Go Wrong, plus developmental psychology researcher and assistant professor of criminal justice at Virginia Commonwealth University, Dr. Haley Cleary. Thank you all so very much for making time
for
us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Podcasts of this program are available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. When you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will find links to more information about all of our guests and the work they are doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.